right. So we ended up on chapter 6 after these long discussions of what was happening in 4 and 5. And I was thinking about this last night. Actually, I was dreaming about this. And I thought, okay, maybe what we really need to do is back up and say, but why would Paul even bother with all this stuff? I mean, he's writing a letter to these people he hasn't met, and he clearly seems to want to tell them something about Jewish history, because he talks about Abraham, and he talks about Adam, and he talks about Yeshua, but you notice he never talks about Moses, which is really interesting, okay? So I thought, let's consider my comment yesterday about the bookends, right? Adam and Yeshua being the bookends. Well, Abraham shows up in the middle. So let's consider what the progression of the argument is. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. This isn't a progression of an argument, because he's writing a letter. And I don't know if you realize that in the first century, very few people wrote their own letters, right? They dictated them. And someone who was good at writing wrote down the dictation for them. That's the way that it was done. In fact, we know that Paul did that for most of his letters, because there's only a few places where he says, I've written this by my own hand, which means he's dictating the letter to be written to a scribe who's now writing this very long letter in ink, probably on parchment, right? Or something like that, okay? So what else did we learn about that? Just the technique. You can't erase. You don't have a delete key, right? You can't go back and say, oh, that's not what I meant, let's start over. Because the fact of the matter is that it was not only expensive, but it was very difficult to actually start over with another thought. So I'm thinking to myself, if I were writing a letter of this length, I would be writing according to how I'm thinking about things. And I know that when I write, and since I write every day, I have a pretty good amount of evidence about this. I often think, oh, I wish I had said it differently. And I go back, I hit the delete key, I erase everything, and you see the final production, with the typos and stuff. But the point is, I have the ability to correct my thinking after I've thought about it. Whereas Paul doesn't have that ability to go back and correct his thinking. He writes as he thinks. And for most of us, you know, James Joyce made that popular in novels. But for most of us, stream of consciousness thought is not always well organized. And so I'm thinking, if Paul is dictating this letter, he's thinking of things as he goes along. And he may say this and say to himself, oh, I should have said this. And then he's got to add that in. So if we start looking at this as a logical progression from one thing to the next, even though he says, therefore, 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 therefore all the time, I think we make a mistake, because we treat it as though he's writing a theology instead of writing a letter. So with that in mind, I thought, let's go back, take a minute, and let's go back and see how he positions Abraham, Adam, and Yeshua. And the first thing that I thought of, as soon as I thought to myself, what does he say about Abraham? The first thing I thought of is, Abraham is, one, the father of the covenant, so he's a first, okay? Second, he has a trusting attitude, which then carries over into Yeshua, right? He waits for a promise, which then carries over into Yeshua. His covenant commitment with God includes many nations, right? God recognizes Abraham's willingness to trust and validates it, okay? Abraham accepts the obligations of the covenant commitment, because circumcision happens afterwards. And as a result of that, his behavior becomes a symbolic, becomes a model, a symbol of what we can get, that which is what Paul wants to talk about. You know, we can enter into the same trusting relationship. We can enter into the same obligations to fulfill the covenant. God will recognize us for our willingness. There will be a promise that extends beyond our lifetime. All that kind of stuff happens in Abraham, okay? So then I thought, okay, well then how does Paul treat Adam? And when I look at Adam, I see he's the first exemplar of God's creation of humanity. He's the first to get a commandment. Of all the trees of the garden, you may freely eat, right? He's also the first to act in disobedience to a commandment, right? He's the first to sin, because in that case, sin is a religious concept, right? He actually sins. He doesn't just break an ethical code, okay? And he does not accept the commitment of the covenant relationship, right? Because he doesn't show a trusting attitude. And that impact also comes forward to us, because it puts ego in the middle of the ethical equation, right? In other words, he opens the door for self-determination. Yeah, it might be that he opens the door for sin as a religious concept, but the result is that he actually opens the door so that we decide what's good for us and what isn't good for us, right? As opposed to Abraham, who accepted what God asked him to do without trying to figure out why, okay? And then I look at Yeshua, and he, of course, is the extended model of Abraham and the reversal of Adam. Why? Because Yeshua returns to Abraham's trusting attitude. He waits for the promise. What's the promise? That he'll come back to life. He waits for that, right? He doesn't know it. God validates that promise in raising him from the dead. Yeshua closes the door on self-determination, because that's what happens in the garden. He says, not your will, but mine, or not my will, but yours. And he offers that promise to the many nations. So the three characters, Abraham, Adam, and Yeshua, are all tied together on those same kinds of points, right? And I'm thinking to myself, maybe that's all that Paul's trying to accomplish. Maybe he's not trying to tell this Gentile Jewish audience the long history of Jewish theology, but he's using these people from Jewish history and from contemporary history, his own, right, to show them what was happening in the patterns of these lives and exemplify what he's trying to show them is a return to the Abrahamic commitment, right? And I think that really helped me figure out why he spends so much time dealing with the relationship between Abraham and faithfulness and the lack of faithfulness in Adam, and then turns that around and says, don't you see, Yeshua has brought forward an example of exactly what Abraham showed, okay? So that helps me to understand a little bit. Maybe it'll help you as well, because now we're going to get to chapter 6, and now we start.
Uh-oh, he froze.
Okay, so we'll have to stick with the audio, because I don't know what's happening here. It's just a typical Italian disaster. Okay. So, as I was saying, the first verse in 6 is this rhetorical question, because he's just told you in 5, okay, you don't have to be like Adam. Adam was the person who was disobedient, who didn't trust God, who showed his disobedience in the first sin, and as a result of that, all kinds of other bad things happened for everyone, and Yeshua changes that trajectory, right? And then he says, okay, but now you think, oh, well, Yeshua fixed everything, so we can just continue in our ordinary life. And he says, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? In other words, one of the rabbi's prayers is, God, you have lots of grace, and we have lots of sins. So please forgive us, because you need to use up your grace, right? And the idea is that Paul's saying, well, God has plenty of grace, but he needs something to do with it, so we should just have more sins so that he has more things to do, okay? And, of course, he's gonna deny that possibility, because he wants to make the following point. May it never be, he says. How shall we, who died to sin, still live in it? And it's important now that we move to Uriel ben Mordecai's translation, because remember, the P46 is available in this particular chapter. So let's see how he translates this. He says, such a thing never was, nor could it be. It is an illusion for those of us planning wrongdoing. How is it possible that we should still live life under its influence? Okay? So pretty much the same thing that it says in the Greek text that gets translated into the New English Bible. May it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live with it? And then he continues the same thought. Or do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus have been baptized into his death? Okay, so this is really interesting because the word there, baptized, is an unusual word used in the Greek text as a singular, whereas in the Hebrew thought, it's plural, right? And of course, Christians make a big deal out of this because what they're saying is, you see, there's one baptism into life. But I think what they miss is that Yeshua is, I mean, that Paul is talking about the importance of this particular baptism, right? Urban ben Mordecai writes, do you not realize that as many of us who have undergone a mikvah in light of Mashiach Yeshua, we are undergoing a mikvah reflecting his death? And what he's saying is the mikvah that occurs as the result of a commitment to the life in the messianic community isn't the only baptism, but it's a special one because it symbolizes the transference from the pagan world into the messianic Jewish community. So the fact that it's used as a singular in the New Testament, I think, is not sufficient grounds for saying that they only got baptized once, right? Because obviously they live in a Jewish world where that happens every time they go to the temple, etc. He says, but the point that he wants to make is that it's a baptism as a symbolic commitment to the death of Yeshua, not the resurrection yet, right? And of course, what he's saying is, if you died, then you are no longer under the master who exercised control over you when you were alive. So he says, therefore, we have been buried with him through baptism into death, in order that as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. So as far as Paul is concerned, the symbolic rite of baptism initiates a new lease on life. And we view life differently than we did before because we've made this public display of our commitment to the kind of life that was modeled in the Messiah. Okay? So then he says, for if we have become united with him in the likeness of his death, certainly we shall also be in the likeness of his resurrection. And so now Paul finally introduces the idea that if you're connected with Yeshua because you've made this symbolic commitment to live the kind of life that he lived, you also have the promise that life will continue, and it was validated by God in the resurrection. So just as Abraham's promise extends to many nations, so will this promise. In other words, Yeshua is, in this sense, is like Abraham. A promise was made to him that extends to many. Okay? Now, knowing this, that our old self was crucified with him, that our body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin. Okay. Now let's look at Uriel ben Mordecai's translation of this at 6:6. Okay. Recognizing that our old humanity, far better than that our old self, because self it's not a Jewish concept. Self is a Greek concept, right? So we don't have, so it's unlikely that Paul is thinking of the Greek idea of the self, the psuche. And so I think Uriel ben Mordecai's translation is far closer to a Hebrew idea when he says, recognizing that our old humanity is going to be executed with the intention of putting an end to the physical conduit of the act of sin, in which we never again have to be controlled by the activity of sin. Okay, and I think that that's probably closer to the Hebrew idea, with one exception, and that is when Uriel ben Mordecai translates an end to the physical conduit of the act of sin, because then that makes it look like sin is only there because of the presence of the body, which allows a temptation that we succumb to. Okay? And that, again, is a Greek idea. It's not a Hebrew idea.
Skip.
So I would think that, yes.
Sorry to interrupt. In your version of Uriel's, does it have the body in a bracket in blue text beside conduit?
It has it in the amplified version, yes.
Okay.
With the intention of putting it into the physical conduit or body.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But see, I think that's a mistake because Hebrew doesn't treat sin as though it's only the result of having a physical body. That's the Greek idea of the separation of body, mind, and spirit, so that, you know, the spirit is pure and holy, but it's the body that all the temptations come through. And I don't think that that's a Hebrew idea and probably shouldn't be translated that way. It should be translated as person, but not body, maybe, or as people, right? Knowing this, that our humanity was crucified with him, that our person, the whole of us, the nishma, the nefesh, right? The whole idea is that we won't be part of this old version of humanity that keeps us locked in temptation and under the power of this, this force that Paul treats, as we'll see when we get to chapter 7, he treats it almost as an alien force, okay? Because he says that's going to be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin, okay? So he says in 7, for he who has died is freed from sin. And the analogy is pretty good, but I'm not sure that it helps us understand how it's going to work in our lives, because he's right. If you're dead, you're not tempted. It's as simple as that. If you're dead, you no longer have to deal with all of the stuff that goes on in your life that causes you to fall back under the temptation of self-determined ego behavior. Okay, so theoretically he's correct. The problem is doing the shift necessary so that you see yourself as dead to the kinds of things that you experienced in the past, right? We're going to see how he develops this. Hold on just a second. Oh, by the way, what does Uriel say there? He says, the truth of the matter is that one who dies has been tested. He departs away from the act of sinning. But I'm not sure, unless I could look at the P46, I'm not sure I could understand where he gets the idea of tested. As he says, he has completed the testing of life. But that's true. If he's dead, he no longer is going to be, he's no longer susceptible to the influences of sin. But the problem is, it's a nice thought. I'm not sure how it actually works out. We'll have to see, okay? So he says, now, if we have died with Christ, we believe that we shall also live with him. And so here's the parallel. If you've been baptized into his death, because God validated the commitment that he made to the Yeshua, the Messiah, you can also expect the same validation of the commitment that you make, right? You followed in Abraham's footsteps when you had trusting faith and you accepted the obligations of the covenant, and Paul's making the same argument here, that if you follow in the footsteps of the Messiah, you can expect the same validation to occur, okay? And then he says, knowing that Christ, having been raised from the dead, is never to die again. Death no longer is master over him, okay? And Uriel ben Mordecai says of that particular verse, 10. The fact is, in his dying, the possibility of sin died forever, and now he lives for God. But that's really interesting, because it isn't the possibility. Okay, if he treat Paul as though he's making an analogy of the literal fact of someone being dead, then you could say, yes, the possibility of a dead person sinning is not going to happen, because the dead person is not subject to temptation. And so the analogy works as long as the person is dead. what Paul's trying to do is to get us to see that that baptism represents a symbolic death, so that you move out of the realm of the influence of sin and you adopt a new way of life that acts as though you're dead to those influences. Okay? The problem, of course, is that you're not dead. Right? So now we'll have to figure out what he means by that. And he says, for the death that he died to sin once for all. But the life that he lives to God. Okay, so now I want to raise a real interesting question about that. Because it's in the English translation, it's for the death that he died to sin once for all. Which, of course, is the Christian idea that the death on the cross was the substitute for all humanity's sin. Okay? So let's take a look at how Uriel ben Mordecai translates that verse. It's number 10. And he says, the fact is, in his dying, the possibility of sin died forever. But that's not the same as once for all. And now that he lives for God. And that's, you can see that it's significantly different than for the death that he died to sin once for all. But the life that he lives for God. So we're okay at the end of the verse. And now that he lives for God. But where did the once for all come from? Because in our English translation, we have this interesting phrase that makes it look like Yeshua's death was a substitutionary atonement. And so for that, we have to look at the Greek text.
Skip in the new NASB, it says once for all time.
Ah, now maybe they've corrected everything. Ah, because I have the 1995 version. Okay, once for all time would make a lot more sense, but let's see what happens when we look at the Greek and how they arrived at that, okay? So,
but time is in italics.
In the Greek text, what?
Time is in italics.
Once which means it isn't in the italics. They added it. Yeah, so once for all is actually how it reads, and the word is in the Greek, hapex. So here is the if hapex means at once or once for all. So now we have to decide, how did they get once for all out of this? Okay, once for all with reference to the uniqueness of Christ's death, and he cites Romans 6:10, by which sin and Christ are quits. So that in him we can die to sin in an irreversible turning to God. That, of course, is the Christian understanding of the word. Okay? Christ offered himself once for all in contrast to the high priests with their daily sacrifices. But, of course, that is to interpret the verse as though it is a proof text for substitutionary atonement. Now, it also says once for all used in the New Testament for the definitive Christian state and the one baptism, right, suggests a proverbial saying similar to having once tasted blood. It is unnatural to let the gift go again. The point here is that there was no once for all cleansing by the old offerings. So again, we have the description of the verse in terms of Christian theology, right? So what we really want to know is, now that we know that they translated that according to once for all based on their theology, what does the word actually mean, right? How is it used? And so we find once as a strictly numerical concept with reference to the last time, the double repetition in verses 27, 28, and 3, the application of verse 28, this is all from Hebrews, where Christ is the one offering as well as the one high priest. The term then takes on significance for Christ's second coming as well. None of this helps us, because all it does is support the theological paradigm of the substitutionary atonement. So here's the problem. If we look at the way Uriel ben Mordecai translates this verse, the fact is in his dying, the possibility of sin died forever, and now that he lives for God. We recognize that whatever has happened in the Greek text since the P46, has added the words once for all. Because if those words are not in the P46, then where do they come from? Right? I mean, it doesn't help very much to put in once for all time in italics. The problem is the very word itself, hapax, once, right? And I'm pretty sure that if it had been in the text, Uriel ben Mordecai would have translated some word that's connected with the idea of one time, okay? The explanation that Paul's only referring to the one-time death of the Messiah is fine because it only happened once, but it isn't fine if we connect it to this notion that his death initiated a one-time only substitutionary atonement for all sin. That's the problem. And that gets attached to this idea that there's something in the Greek text which allows us to conclude that Yeshua's death was the death for all sin, for all time, and all of the other sacrifices, as you can see in my reading these comments, all the other sacrifices are now done away with, okay? We'll have to, yes.
Yeah, in the Complete Jewish Bible, David Stern translates that verse. He said, for his death was a unique event that need not be repeated, but his life he keeps on living for God.
Okay, and so he's taken the once for all as a unique event, which of course is the initial meaning of the word hapex, a strictly numerical concept, right? In other words, it's a one-time thing. It only happens once. But that's different than the connection to substitutionary atonement. So here we have a real problem, and that is that the current Greek text has a word in it that the P46 doesn't have. Okay? And of course, the current Greek text is the one that's used for most English translations, although fortunately, David Stern seems to have realized that it can't be about substitutionary atonement. Okay? So that's the first issue. The second issue comes only a couple of verses later. Okay, so he says, even so, consider yourselves to be dead to sin, but alive to God in Jesus Christ. In other words, follow the same pattern, right? His death was a one-time event, but it shows that God validated the commitment that he made in trusting obedience, and you can do the same thing. Therefore, you model the Messiah, no problem, okay? Then he says, 12, therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey its lusts. And now we have a nice Greek concept, right? So Uriel ben Mordecai translates accordingly. The activity of sin should not be in control within your human body so as to give way to it, okay? Same idea, but unfortunately, I don't think a very Hebrew idea, because in the Hebrew context, it isn't bodily sins that are the only problem. Right? I mean, quite frankly, idolatry isn't a bodily sin. Right? So and this is because Paul has used, let me see if I'm pretty sure this is correct, that he uses the word soma. Hold on just a second. We're in 12, my mistake. 12. Do not let sin reign in your mortal body. So do not let sin reign in your mortal, which is a very interesting. Yes, he uses the word soma, okay? But it's interesting that the word for mortal that he uses is a verb from the word thanatos, which means death, right? So he doesn't actually say, do not let sin reign in your mortal body. He basically continues with the same analogy that he had before. Do not let sin have mastery over the body, your body that's dead, right? And that makes perfect sense, because what he said is, the person that you are, who died in connection with the baptism, with the symbolic baptism into Christ's death, is not the person that you are now. And that person, that dead person, no longer is under the sway of the principles that motivated that person in the first place, because that person is dead. So rather than mortal body, it should probably be translated the dead body, right? There, because look, if we don't make that distinction, then we have this horrible Platonic dualism going on, where the soul is immune from and can be spiritual, but the body is physical and subject to temptation. And that's certainly not what Paul has in mind, because that's a very Platonic concept that Paul doesn't embrace, right? Paul has to use the word soma because there isn't any Hebrew word, there isn't any Greek word which captures the whole of the Hebrew concept of neshima or nefesh, right? Because nefesh isn't the body, nefesh is the whole person. So what he's saying is that whole person that is now dead, that person doesn't respond to the temptations of sin anymore, because that whole person, the spiritual, the ethical, the volitional, the cognitive, that person is dead. So there's no possibility that that sin can influence that person. I think that's more what he has in mind. Okay? Now, he says, so therefore, do not let sin reign in the body that is now dead, that you should obey its lusts, and do not go on presenting the members of your body. Now, this is really interesting, because now it looks like he's saying, oh my gosh, all those physical things about you, they're the real problem. If you just get rid of the physical, you'd be fine. Okay, so we need to find out what he means by members of the body, right? And for that we have members of the body. Mele is the Greek word, and it means parts. It can also mean song. Members of the body, that is, Parmenides takes on an abstract sense of akin to elements, okay? And in the Septuagint, it's used for both human and animal bodily parts, okay? Let's see what happens in rabbinic theology. In rabbinic theology, it relates to the 248 commands of the law that include members of the parts of the body and 365 prohibitions. As regards to the most important member, it suggests that the head, but also the heart, are the really, you know, what's important. And the synoptists, Jesus contrasts the single members with the whole body. The eye and the hand are members with a very important function, but they're treated here as subjects of action. And so what we really might think of, rather than Paul talking about members, the problem with my hand, the problem with my eye, but what he might really be talking about is the actions that are expressed by hand or eye, the actions that are expressed by feet, right? So it's not the individual physical members that are the problem, but it's the behavior that comes through them, okay? So if that were the case, then he would say, and do not go on presenting the actions that are associated with your body as instruments of unrighteousness. In other words, change your behavior, right? But present yourselves, and it's interesting that he says, presenting the members of your body in the first part of the verse, and present yourselves in the second part. So clearly he doesn't have in mind just your physical being, because he doesn't repeat it. Present yourselves to God as those alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness. And members as instruments, again, an instrument is of no value unless it's performing what it's supposed to do. So my suggestion is that what he's got in mind here is as close as he can get to the term nefesh. And what he means is the whole person, the actively engaged, cognitive, moral, volitional person, right? And now let's see how Uriel ben Mordecai translates this. 13, and dedicate the parts of your body as tools of depravity en route to the activities of sin. Instead, set yourselves apart to serve God as if out from the dead, living again, and the parts of your body as tools of uprightness before God. But the point is, not the, my point is, it's not the members, it's the behavior that's associated with them, because the tool doesn't have any value until it's put to use, which is a really nice Hebrew concept as well. The meaning of the thing in, is in its purpose. So what Paul is saying is, the result of your baptism into the death of Christ changes your thinking about the purpose of your being. And that means that you change your personality so that it serves as a an instrument for God. And how does that happen? Because my behavior changes to reflect this new orientation. Okay? And now I want to get to this really interesting verse. Okay, so that was 13. Okay, so here's 14. This is a really, really important verse. For sin shall not be master over you, for you are not under law, but under grace. And there it is. The Lutheran, Augustinian, Calvinist idea that we, as Christians, are freed from the law. Could it get any plainer than that? You are not under law, but under grace. How in the world could you miss the point of Paul that the law doesn't apply to you anymore? Okay, so first I want to look at Uriel ben Mordecai's translation, and then I want to talk about the Greek words that are involved here. He says, Uriel ben Mordecai, for all intents and purposes, sin should not sway you. And here's what happens with Uriel ben Mordecai. I'll read it to you first. Honestly, are you not under the control of Torah law and unequivocally under the control of benevolence? In other words, the way that Uriel ben Mordecai gets around this is to claim that it's a question, not a statement, right? Now, can he legitimately do that? Of course, because there's no punctuation in Greek. So is Paul saying, for you are not under law, but under grace, as a statement? Or is he saying, for are you not under law, but under grace, as a question, right? The whole point is, without punctuation, we don't know what Paul meant. We have to supply the context. So for that, I thought we should look at a couple of things. The first, of course, is that we're going to look at the Christian explanation of this verse. And then I want to go back and look at something that happens in this verse that's really quite unusual. Let me go here, 14. Okay, so here's the Christian explanation. And it comes from Leon Morris's commentary. Okay, he says, sin must not have any hold over you. But Paul's statement is stronger than that. As Perry says, it is a promise, not a command. Paul has, of course, given commands, and he's never afraid to introduce another one. But here, he's pointing to the reason why commands like those he has just given can be obeyed. Believers can present their members to God as for righteousness precisely because sin has no lordship over them. They are free. Now listen. Because, he's talking about the word choti, because introduces the reason. Dunn points out that it is a new thing to have law and grace set over against one another as they are here. No kidding, it's a new thing, right? What's interesting is if I read Paul as though he's opposing law and grace, I have read Paul as though he's not a part of the Jewish world. Because, as Dunn points out, that would never happen in the Jewish context. So the first thing that has to happen when I translate this verse from Paul is I have to think that Paul is a Christian and he's opposed to the Jewish context. Okay, but that's not all. Then he says, he comments, it is not that anyone said righteousness is by law and not by grace. No one posed grace and law as alternatives. Rather, they saw law as the gift of grace. And he's right. That's exactly how the Jewish world saw it. Law is the gift of grace. That's what we saw in Abraham, right? Paul makes the point that Abraham's trusting obedience ended up in him serving God according to the law, okay? So listen to what he says. It was Paul who posed them as alternatives. Paul saw clearly that law and grace do not go together. If one is under one, he is not under the other. In the view of the place Paul's Jewish contemporaries ascribed to the law, we must be clear that the apostle saw it as in opposition to the way of grace and thus an impossible way of salvation for a Christian. So there it is. This verse, this one verse, becomes the most important theological text for arguing that grace and law do not fit together. Okay? So obviously we want to know how in the world are we supposed to read this verse. So you can see that Ben Mordecai decides he's going to change it into a question, which takes away some of the impact, some of the bite. But there's another interesting thing going on here. Let me see if I can find it in this book. Ah, yes, here we go. Okay. Here's the point. If we go to this verse and we look at, you are under, yeah, I gotta find it now, hold on. Therefore, you are under the law, okay? Yeah, okay, so here's what he says. We're going to look at the word grace, okay? Because the word for law, we know already, it's nomos. And we know that Paul uses it in 9 or 10 different ways, okay? And he could use this as you're not under the ethical expectations and obligations of the general society. But even if he uses it in a broad term like that, and not in particular about the Mosaic code, the question is, how can he oppose that to the idea of grace? So we need to know what grace means, okay? And the Greek word is charis, okay? Now we think, oh my gosh, it's clear that Paul is opposing law and grace because charis means grace. But in fact, charis means a whole bunch of other things as well. And kario is the verb that means to rejoice, right? It means joy. It means freely given, it means favor, it means blessing, it means thanks, it means gratefulness, okay? So what if Paul was saying, you are no longer under the law, but you are under joy, you're under thankfulness, you're under gratitude, right? You're under blessing, you're under favor. Now, all of a sudden, the opposition of law and grace, as though grace is the means of salvation and law isn't, goes away. Because, this is really interesting, notice this one interesting thing. I gotta find it now, hold on. This is in the Qumran. Oh yeah, here we go. So, in the New Testament, kario is the secular term and agaliomai is the religious term, okay? But he says, but the two may be synonymous, but we're not quite sure. So I thought, okay, so let's go look it up and see what it says. Because if it's a secular term, then it doesn't mean grace in the sense of a means for salvation, does it? If it's a secular term, then so I thought, okay, let's look at this and see what it says. The underlying term, gallio, is common in Greek prose and poetry. It means to adorn. Hence the middle galliomai means to plume oneself. Okay? Galliomai in the Septuagint and in Judaism is a new biblical construct used mostly in Hebrew. It denotes cultic joy in God's help and acts. Okay, did you get that? So here's the interesting thing. If we pay attention to the word in its opposition to a religious term, we can't possibly come to the conclusion that grace, that what Paul means by grace, is a salvation term that is opposed to law. It's almost as if Paul is saying in 14, for sin shall not be master over you because you are not under the ethical obligations of society and the expectations of society, but you're under favor. You're under God's blessing. You're under what causes you to have joy, right? And the opposition between law and grace that everybody points out only occurs in Paul goes away.
Hey, Skip.
It's very clear that if Paul is thinking in Hebrew, he cannot possibly claim that law is not related to grace. He can't claim that they're in opposition. So that means if I translate the verse according to Reformed theology, then I will oppose law and grace. But if I translate the verse according to Hebraic thinking, I will see that what he's saying is, hey, listen, the reason that you act the way you do is because you have experienced God's benevolence and you are now responding to his goodness, right? Which is not to say that you're not obedient. It just means that you have a different reason for obeying. It doesn't come because of obligation or because of a requirement. It comes because you've made a commitment that God has validated and you've chosen to serve him in that way. And it seems to me that's exactly how he would connect this to the idea of Abraham and the idea of Yeshua, that they served willingly, but not out of obligation. They served because they experienced the favor and goodwill of God. Okay? Now, more than happy to take some questions on this because a super critical verse when it comes to trying to understand how it gets translated like this.
Yeah, Skip? Skip?
Yeah.
On the complete Jewish Bible, Stern translates that well. He says, because you're not under legalism, but under grace, which is interesting. A good translation, I think.
And I appreciate it. Yes. If he translates it legalism, I appreciate that. The word is still nomos, and it can mean legalism. But right. The problem is that he's still contrasting it with grace, which in the Christian mind means the salvation provided by God through the death and resurrection of Jesus, as though all I have to do is say the sinner's prayer and God's grace pours out on me, which is why, and it might be that legalism is what Paul has in mind, but it still doesn't. Here's the problem, is whenever I read this verse, somehow it's read as though there's an opposition here. And what I'm trying to say is, you're not under, as Stern says, you're not under a legalistic obligation. You do what you do because you are under God's benevolence, because you've experienced his goodwill, because you've had joy in God, right? Which is a very different concept than the notion of grace. And the reason that that's important is because the Greek term has all of those meanings. We just, the translators picked the one that fits the Christian paradigm, but they didn't give you the option to see that where it means a religious term, it's a different Greek word, right? That this term is really more like joy and favor than it is about religious sanctification, right? That's what I'm trying to get at, that we treat grace as though it's a religious word, but in fact in the New Testament there's a separate word for that and it's not grace.
Yeah, in fact the Orthodox Jewish Bible the Orthodox Jewish Bible translates that you're under hesed. It doesn't say grace, you're under hesed.
Hesed, yeah. That's definitely an extension, because the usual Greek word for hesed is elios, mercy, but it's possible because that involves the whole process of mutual obligation, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be right. It's God's favor, it's the obligation, it's the transitivity, it's all that concerned, right? And that makes more sense from Paul's perspective than this notion that somehow Paul was the first person ever to oppose law and grace. Okay? Somebody else?
Yeah, Skip, Larry.
Hi, Larry.
Hey, good morning. Hey, following the context of Paul's thinking, he's just said in verse 12 that you're not supposed to sin. So why in 14 would anybody think you're supposed to sin? It doesn't make any difference, right? So follow that. The other thing, what's interesting is I studied with Uriel, or Phyllis and I did for quite a while. What's interesting about him is he speaks English, he speaks Hebrew, and he speaks Greek, and he understands the language. So what I really find interesting about verse 4, if you look at it, is the word 14. But. Is the word but. Notice what he says.
In which
says,
verse? In which 14. Verse?
In verse 14.
14.
Right? Yeah, where he says but, he says it can be defined as unequivocally. It completely changes the translation, right? So he says, are you not under the law, right? Unequivocally under grace completely changes it, because that word can be used either way. We look at but as an instead, but he's saying it's unequivocally. That to me is a critical word. That definition of that word right there completely changes it. Look at his writing.
Okay.
Uriel's writing.
Go back and look at 14. For all intents and purposes, sin should not sway you. Honestly, are you not under the control of Torah law? Okay. So in his written text here, he has honestly rather than unequivocally. And I'm just looking at the Hebrew word gar, which we've run into over and over and over in Paul. And it can mean for, because, certainly, by all means, to introduce a reason, to introduce a reason for. So it's possible that it could be translated certainly, right, or unequivocally. Certainly, sin shall not be master over you. And that would change it into the reason for his question, right? Which he reads as, for all intents and purposes, certainly, sin should not sway you. Honestly, are you not under the control of Torah law? Right? Sin shall not be master over you. For, that's the second gar, I think. Let's find out. Hold on just a second. For. Yeah, it's the same word, gar. It's used twice in the verse, right? Certainly, you would say certainly, and all Uriel ben Mordecai does is change the statement into a question. Certainly, are you not under, right? Instead of you are not under. And of course, he has plenty of leeway to do that, because the syntax in Greek is completely different than in English. And there's no punctuation. So you can read it as a question and it makes still make perfect sense. Right. And in fact, reading it as a question, as he has done, makes more sense from Paul's perspective, because Paul's not saying that somehow law and grace are opposed to each other. Okay.
Right.
So I understand your point.
Yeah, I just want to add just one final comment. He's actually saying unequivocally under the benevolence. In other words, are you not under the control of the Torah law? Right. Rhetorical question. And unequivocally under the control of benevolence or so grace. Both. So in other words, and certainly under that. So he's saying you're both.
You're both.
And we're completely reading. He's using the word but under the control of benevolence or grace. He's using it there in that but. After he talks about are you not under
the control. I'm reading about it now, and it says, so the word is Allah, and it can mean but, yet, rather, certainly, at least, not only, contrary wise. I have to look. But if you read that as certainly, then right. It makes perfect sense for him to read the verse as a question and translate it as unequivocally under the control of benevolence.
All right, thank you.
And notice that he says under the control. Yeah, I think you're right, Larry, that he has taken he's taken the Hebrew idea of this Greek term Allah to look at it from a different perspective. But notice at the end of the verse, he reads unequivocally under the control of benevolence, right? Which is much closer to our idea of joy, favor, goodwill, but not necessarily the idea of grace in the way that it's used in the Christian world. Okay? Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, the point is that you can see the translation of this particular verse with just a couple of words makes a huge difference in Christian theology. Because Luther, Augustine, Calvin read the verse in the way that it's translated in my NASB, as though grace and law are in opposite, are opposites, right? But as you've seen, we've explored enough of this to realize that grace doesn't mean a means of salvation. It's not a religious term. It's a secular term. And that there's a question about how we understand Allah, the word for but, and we certainly have the right to say, wait a minute, that's a completely non-Hebrew idea. And Paul claims, of course, that he's always been faithful to his Hebraic background. So when somebody like Dunn says Paul's the first one to oppose this, we want to raise a hand and say, wait a minute, how can that be? Paul didn't walk away from his Jewish orientation simply because he embraced the Messiah. So I think that leaves us at 6:14, and we will stop there. But I'm open to, if anybody wants to add comments. That was a good point that you made, Larry. We need to really think about how those prepositions get translated, that's for sure. Anybody else? No? Okay.
Lindy, your mouth is moving, but you're on mute.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to skip. While you were gone for that period of time, I put in the chat a book because somebody had asked about teaching the Talmud and whatever. And a friend of mine who's a rabbi just published this book, and I put it in the chat, and the best place I was told by her to purchase it. When I purchased the book, it's called The Stories They Tell. Her name is Judith Hauptman. Some of her stuff is, yeah, Pam just put the press on it. I did the research, and it was a whole lot more expensive on Amazon than on this other website. So it's just, if you are interested. Some of her stuff is on Safari.
Unfortunately, I didn't see the chat because when I was offline, anything that was put in the chat didn't come through. So again, I have more issues now with not having chat anymore.
Okay.
So I'll try to figure out all this technology by next week. Okay, anything else?
I got a quick question, Skip, about language.
Yes.
You know how you talked about the fact that a candle is not a candle unless it's lit performing as a candle?
Yeah, that's right? A Hebraic idea.
So how does that work in English as far as our language?
The difference is that that Hebrew is a language that's principally directed by verbs. So it's the action that matters, not the essence. So in English, because we have a Greek-based language, we believe that a word describes the essence of something. So a candle is wax and a wick, right? It doesn't have to be lit to be a candle. But in Hebrew, until it serves its purpose, it doesn't have meaning. So it might be wax and wick, but it doesn't become a candle until it's lit. You need to apply the same thing here. So when Paul's talking about sin won't reign in your members, he's not saying that the essence of your body is a soup of temptation. What he's saying is that the behaviors are what matters in Hebrew. It's what you do, right? And so he can talk about the dead person no longer is susceptible to sin because he doesn't do anything anymore. He's no longer sensitive to the world, right? That's the example from Hebrew. But that means that if that's Paul's thinking, it also can't mean that when he says you're no longer under sin, but unequivocally under grace, what he means, what he can only mean is that there's some behavioral issue that's going on there. It isn't just a matter of my cognitive reevaluation, right? That there has to be some connection between what I do and what I'm thinking. And of course, for the rabbis, that meant that I made the commitment, the same commitment that Abraham made, but the fulfillment of the Mosaic Code follows that commitment, hand in glove. It isn't separate from it, okay? That's why I think Michael Stanley's suggestion of the Jewish Orthodox Bible using the word chesed there is really good, because that includes all of that thinking, all of the behaviors that are involved in appropriating God's benevolence to my life. Anything else?
Skip. Can you hear me? Yeah, quick question. Yeah. You said that the word that Paul uses for grace was a secular word.
Carbs.
Right. What would be, did you mention that the, what the religious word was? If you wanted
yes.
To, what was that?
Yeah, if he wanted to use the religious word, he could. He could have. Hold on just a second. The religious word, and it wasn't just unique to Paul. This is the religious word in the New Testament.
Right.
It's agaliomaia. Or agaliomaia, right? It's used in John 15:35, in 1 Peter 4:13, in Jude 24, in Revelation 19:7. It's the, let me see if I can see here. The community rejoices because it senses that is in the, that is it is in the community of the end times established by God's saving act. Paul does not have this term. Right? But for a parallel, look at 1 Corinthians 11:26. The cultic meaning still present in the New Testament in Acts 2:46, right? It's about, in other words, in the religious sense, the word that's used in the New Testament is a religious sense of joy, not a secular sense of joy. Right? So if we're gonna translate that word appropriate to the setting of the first century in Rome, we should translate that word as benevolence, as Earl Ben Mordecai does, or favor, or goodwill, or something like that, because the religious term, which has to do with agios, purity, holiness, isn't used. Paul doesn't even use that term.
Thank you.
Okay? Yep. You can find it right here in this. Okay, I will see you next week. We'll start on Romans 6:15.